Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and I'm pleased to have with me today Kathleen Martin, who is the co-author, along with Stanton Friedman, who we've interviewed several times on the show. The book is Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, the true story of the world's first documented alien abduction. Thank you, Kathleen, for joining us today. I appreciate you spending time with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Kathleen is the niece of Betty Hill, and fortunately had not only been close to many of the incidents or the narrative of the story throughout the years. Many of the photos in the book contain her as well as her aunt and uncle. And basically, I guess you grew up with this story. Is that right, Kathleen?
Absolutely. I was 13 years old when my aunt and uncle had a close encounter with the large, silent, hovering craft in New Hampshire's White Mountains. My uncle Barney had observed non-human entities on board the craft dressed in shiny black uniforms. This was all part of his conscious continuous recall. And my mother was the first person that Betty called. She was 10 years younger than Betty, Betty's sister, and I was seated in the same room. So I was one of the first people ever to hear about this experience.
Well, what were your thoughts as a 13-year-old when you heard this?
I was extremely curious about this. It was new news to me. I think I almost immediately became interested in astronomy. I wanted to learn more about our solar system, and I hadn't even thought of anything beyond our solar system, which appears to be the location of these beings, where their home planet is. So I was just extremely curious at that point.
Well, now we've heard a lot about UFOs, but it's 2012. Would you like to remind people that things were a little bit different then? They weren't quite as, this was not quite as well known.
Absolutely. At that time, no one had ever reported a UFO abduction. There had been contactee cases back in the 1950s of individuals who were reporting contact with benevolent space brothers who were here to spiritually enlighten mankind, but no one had ever reported a UFO abduction as my aunt and uncle did, and no one previously was as credible as my aunt and uncle.
I think it's important to understand that that the UFO interest in our planet probably peaked around the time we started setting off nuclear weapons, probably for a good reason. You know, both the, I guess, the higher-level aliens and the lower-level aliens, both of these groups showed up in larger numbers around that time, probably curious as to what we were doing. And evidently what we were doing with the electromagnetic field of the planet due to the nuclear explosions, as is mentioned in your book.
Yes, absolutely. And when you think about our history and our military history, we have been a predatory species. We have been warlike throughout our history. And this has actually helped to develop our space technology. You wonder what the history of these beings who are visiting Earth was like, and if they went through that same sort of history at some point in their past, and if our explosion of nuclear weapons had actually drawn their attention to Earth and made them come in greater numbers out of concern for what we were doing, whether or not we were going to end up self-destructing.
I don't know whether I told you this, Kathleen, but I did tell Stanton. I was a major at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and I kept getting different people, fairly high-ranking people, telling me that they had seen live or unlive aliens at the base. And they didn't know each other, and then Stanton told me he was doing a book signing in Dayton, and he had like eight different people tell him the same thing that didn't know, you know, that weren't connected to one another. So obviously, at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, something was happening there. I mean, and this was from Roswell, the time of Roswell, and then it continued probably at not only the ships, but oftentimes, the bodies, if dead or alive, would go to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So that was my first introduction to this, was hearing about it at the base.
That's very interesting, and that has been reported many, many times before. Leonard Stringfield was, the late Leonard Stringfield, was a UFO investigator and researcher in Cincinnati, Ohio. And he was one of the first researchers to come out with information about alien bodies at Wright-Patterson.
Yeah, I had watched UFO Files recently, I think last year, and there was one just on Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And in UFO Files, anyway, they said that Wright-Patterson was where the bodies were always taken. And that at some point, they figured out how they were shooting the saucers out of the sky. It had to do with radar. And so they started, at first it was accidental, like at Roswell, but later they tried to do it on purpose, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So that was interesting. But certainly Betty and Barney weren't at all looking for anything to happen, or even had it in their conscious mind that it could happen when it happened to them. You want to tell our listeners a little bit about their story?
You're absolutely correct about that. Barney did not believe that UFOs were real. In fact, he said that if anyone had told them they had observed a UFO, he would not have believed them. Betty was a little more open-minded. She was a social worker for the state of New Hampshire. Barney worked for the post office. They were both active in the civil rights movement in New Hampshire. And Barney a little bit nationally, too, because he was appointed by the governor to serve on the state advisory committee to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. And they were very active politically in the state of New Hampshire and highly respected. Among the groups of people who knew them, they had worked on a literacy program for voters' rights and even were invited guests at Lyndon Johnson's inauguration. So when this story about their close encounter and UFO abduction came out, it was completely out of character for them and really shocked a lot of people. But what happened was that on September 19, 1961, Betty and Barney were returning home to their house on the seacoast of New Hampshire, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, from a trip to Niagara Falls and Montreal. It was just a long weekend trip that they had taken. They decided to drive home during the night because Barney worked all night long anyway. He worked the graveyard shift at the post office, and he was well rested from the night before. They thought that they would stop if they grew tired, but they didn't. And as they were driving home, it was a bright, starry night. There was a waxing gibbous moon in the sky. It would be full in 6 days. And Betty was just observing the scenery and the stars when all of a sudden she saw what looked like a falling star, only it fell upward. And she continued to watch it. It stopped in the sky. And finally, about 15 miles south of where she had first spotted this thing, she asked Barney to stop so she could get about a look at it. She wondered if she was observing a satellite. She had never seen one before. And at that time, we were all very excited about the budding space program in the United States and the Soviet Union. So Barney stopped, and Betty looked at it, but it soon became obvious to her that it wasn't a satellite. It was flashing multicolored lights, and its pattern, flight pattern, was different than what she had expected. Now, Barney took the binoculars, and he looked, and it started moving toward Vermont, and then, without looking as if it had turned, it sprung back in his direction, stopping within about 1,000 feet of him, he estimated. He got back into the car and headed south to Franconia Notch, and that's a very beautiful scenic area of New Hampshire. As he entered the north side of the notch, Betty observed the craft then traveling over the top of Cannon Mountain. There's an aerial tramway there. There's a restaurant on top and also a signal tower. And when the craft passed over the signal tower, the lights blinked out. They were pretty curious about this and were looking for another place to stop. And just south of there was the Old Man of the Mountain. Gave them the opportunity to pull over and get a better look at this thing again. They got out of the car with their binoculars, and the craft at that point was hovering just alongside the Old Man of the Mountain's profile. Now, the profile was 48 feet from forehead to chin line, and Betty said that the craft was at least 1.5 times the length of the Old Man's profile. So you can see at this point it was very large and very close. It appeared to be rotating then. And as Betty and Barney watched it, it continued to have the appearance of jumping back and forth in the sky and also moving in a stair-step pattern. It was large, it was silent, and at that point the lighted windows of the craft were very visible to them, and along this forward edge. So as it appeared to be rotating, they'd see this blip, blip, blip of lights that reminded them of the shape of a cigar. They got back into the car and headed south. Barney was anxious just to arrive home at that point. And so they headed south, exited the south entrance of Franconia Notch at an area called Indian Head. And this is where the motels began. There are some tourist attractions there. But this was the off-season, so there wasn't much activity. Betty was becoming excited at that point. And Barney decided that he wanted to get another look. She was excited because the craft was moving in closer and closer and seemed to be playing a game of cat and mouse with their car. So before Barney had the opportunity to actually pull over for a better look, the craft shifted ahead of them and descended in their direction. Barney had to stop the car directly in the middle of the road, straddling the yellow line in the center, and the craft then hovered approximately 100 to 200 feet above them. It looked like a giant pancake, they said. They could see this row of windows along the forward edge. There was an intense blue-white light coming from behind those windows. Barney stepped out of the car with the binoculars to look up at it as Betty watched it from the passenger seat. And as Barney stepped out, the craft then changed location again in sort of an arc-like kind of flight pattern. It flew to an adjacent field that was just to the east of Barney's location, and he followed it into the field. It was now even lower than it had been before, and as Barney looked up at it through binoculars, he had conscious recall of observing what he said were about 8 to 11 figures standing behind the windows looking down at him. He could see them all the way from the tops of their heads down to about their knees at that point. He was very curious about this, and they apparently were curious about him as well. All of a sudden, all but one of these figures moved away from the window to what appeared to be a panel on the back of this corridor that encircled the craft, and their arms went up. And when they did, the craft tilted in Barney's direction, and something started to drop out of the bottom of the craft. He didn't know what it was, but he could see something coming down from the bottom. Also, he could see a red light on each side of the craft that seemed to be sliding out from the sides of this. And, of course, it was a circular craft. The figure at the window held intense concentration, it seemed, on Barney. And this frightened Barney terribly. He told Walter Webb, who was the first investigator on the case for NICAP, that he thought that he was going to be plucked from that field like a bug in a net. Those were his words. He was so frightened. The one looking down at him was obviously not human, and Barney thought that they were going to capture him. So he had difficulty pulling the binoculars down away from his eyes. Something seemed to have a hold on him, but he was able to do it. He ran back to the car, screaming to Betty that they had to get out of there or they were going to be captured. And when he did this, the craft again shifted location to above the vehicle. He went speeding down U.S. Highway Route 3, that's the major north-south route through upstate New Hampshire that they were traveling on, and he told Betty to roll down the window and look up at this craft. She did, but she was looking for the lights. She didn't see the lights. All she saw was blackness. She couldn't see the moon or the stars. She couldn't see the sky above. Mm. So she and Barney thought that the craft must have been directly over the top of their vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
When all of a sudden, they heard a series of code-like beeping or buzzing sounds. And those sounds caused the car to vibrate and caused a tingling sensation to pass through Betty's and Barney's bodies. Now, the next thing they remembered was they were 35 miles down the road, and they were being jolted by another series of these sounds. They could remember very little of what had happened in the interim. They remembered a fiery orb in the road, silhouetted against some trees. They remembered encountering a roadblock somewhere along the way. They didn't know when or where. They then just continued on to their home in Portsmouth.
And Barney still was having trouble believing in UFOs, is that right? Even after this.
Well, Barney knew what he had observed was not a conventional aircraft.
Right.
But he
right.
told Betty that they should just forget about the whole thing. They shouldn't tell anybody because no good could come out of it. And so that was his opinion. Betty, however, was a very curious person, and she wanted to learn more about it. She went to the phone and she called my mother. She was concerned also that the craft had hovered so close to them that they might have been contaminated. So we had a neighbor who was a physicist, and my mother agreed to call him. And he then recommended that if Betty had a compass, she should take it to the car to see how the compass would react around the car. And I have no idea what knowledge he had that we didn't have that caused him to say that. And I think that he's now deceased. I've never been able to get in touch with him. But Betty took the compass out, and she observed some shiny concentric circles on the trunk of the vehicle that hadn't been there the day before. She placed the compass near them, and the needle would spin and spin. But when she moved it a few inches away, it would drop down. So this was also something that was very perplexing.
And how many of these spots were there on the car?
There were about 12 to 18 spots. I also observed these spots, and of course it mm-hmm. happened when I was 13. So, and I've always wanted to know more. So recently I was hypnotized, and hypnotic regression. I went back and remembered what I could about those spots, and I counted 13 spots under hypnosis. They were shiny, and they seemed to be in a pattern. I had always thought they were scattered over the trunk, but they seemed to be more of in a triangular pattern to me in my recall under hypnosis.
So something had changed the metal. This is metal, I assume. Didn't have plastics cars back then. The metal spinning magnetized the metal in a circular pattern.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you know if we have anything that can do that now? I mean, on Earth?
I don't know of anything that can do that, but I can tell you that in many other cases of UFO landings, the same kind of effect has been observed.
And also, many times when craft are near, the electrical system of whatever's around goes out, like you mentioned before with the lights and or the car, vehicle, whatever. There must be a high electromagnetic field to do that, probably.
Absolutely.
Right. So do you think the car was lifted up at all, or do you think what Betty and Barney remember is more likely?
I suspect that the car was lifted up, and the reason I suspect that is that Betty and Barney's memories sort of ended after that first series of beeps when they were under separate hypnosis with Dr. Benjamin Simon. Now, he hypnotized both of them separately for a period of about 6 months in 1964, and during that time, one of them waited in a soundproof room while the other one was undergoing hypnosis. Dr. Simon imposed amnesia at the end of each session, so they couldn't contaminate each other.
Right.
They didn't know what they had said. So this is what happened during their hypnosis, and they both seemed very confused after those beeping or buzzing sounds on the trunk. They stopped talking. They stopped talking to Dr. Simon for a little while and trying to figure out what happened next. And each of them said that they found themselves on a new road, and they had no idea how they had arrived on that road. There was no way that they could have turned onto that road by mistake. There was no fork in the road off from Route 1 at Route 3 that could have put them there. But they both made that statement. Barney was again driving for a short distance, and then he made a very sharp left-hand turn, which didn't seem to be anticipated, onto a dirt road that was a logging road back then.
And he doesn't remember doing that.
No, he had no intention of doing that.
Of doing that, right.
Yes. Betty had some conscious recall of Barney doing that, she said, that of making that sharp turn, but Barney had no conscious recall of it.
Well, perhaps the car was just turned on its own, too. That would be more likely.
The craft seemed to be in control.
Maneuvering
Barney
the car.
Or
of
the car.
And then what happened after that, according to the hypnotic recall?
Well, according to the hypnosis, just as they recalled vaguely without hypnosis, they met a roadblock. At first, they wondered if there was an accident ahead. Then when men started to approach the car, were they being robbed? What was going on here? They were very confused. And then they noticed that these beings were not human. And at that point, they became very concerned. Betty tried to escape She wanted to run into the woods, but they intercepted her before she was able to get out of the car. Three went to her door. This was not in the hypnosis, by the way. This was not in Betty's dream material, and she did have a series of dreams that has always caused one to wonder if the hypnosis was a real event. But the hypnosis event was different from Betty's dreams, and Betty's and Barney's statements were the same on this. She she tried to run into the woods. They intercepted her. Three went to Barney's door and intercepted him and took them out of the car and down a path through the woods. Barney was seemed to be levitated a bit. His arms were outstretched. His toes were bumping along the rocks. He could feel that. He could feel them riding up a ramp on this craft. Betty regained consciousness and started struggling, gave one a quick kick, tried to get away. They were taken onto the craft and given separate physical examinations in separate rooms.
And one of the more interesting things is that Barney had dentures and Betty had her teeth, and that confused them.
Yes, that was one thing that Betty mentioned, having happened to her, and Barney mentioned that he had felt a couple of fingers entering his mouth. These exams were very different than any physical examination that Betty and Barney had ever had before. It seems that these non-humans were attempting to determine the differences between human beings and themselves. During this exam, they were very interested in Betty and Barney's skeletal system, in their joints. They moved their joints on various parts of their bodies. They were interested in taking a sample of their skin and also looking into the different openings in the human body and taking samples from those openings as well.
And Betty was able to communicate with them, whereas I imagine Barney did not consciously remember doing that.
No, Barney was very apprehensive about doing anything. He opened his eyes once when he was on the craft. He could only describe to Dr. Simon what he was hearing, this kind of sound around him, and he sensed that there were beings standing around him, and then he could tell Dr. Simon what they were doing to various parts of his body. But he sensed that if he just remained very quiet and he didn't move and he cooperated, that they wouldn't harm him. And
which is probably the thoughts they were putting in his head.
Yes.
You know,
because telepathic communication. It was telepathic communication with Betty as well. But she
communicated back.
Yes. At one point, she was able to overcome her fear of them. And this was after her physical examination had been completed. She was harmed during the physical examination. Medical examiner plunged a very long needle into her navel, telling her it wasn't going to hurt. It hurt,
and
so
it did.
Intensely. Yes, it absolutely did. And in fact, Dr. Simon had to end that session early because the event was so traumatic for Betty.
Yeah, well, sure.
Yes, but after that, she began to trust them because the one that she called the leader, who seemed to be her personal escort, took her pain away. And so she felt that they were not going to harm her. She felt that he was somewhat apologetic for what had happened. And that is when she started to communicate with him. That's when the information about the dentures came up, and also she asked him where he was from, and he produced this holographic image, and the image showed a number of different stars of varying sizes. Some were as large as a nickel, and others were only pinpoints on this map. And some were connected by solid lines, several of them, and some were not connected at all. Some others were connected by dotted lines. The solid lines, she assumed or was told, represented places that they went to often, whereas mm-hmm. the dotted lines were expeditions. So mm-hmm. she was very impressed by this. She wanted to know exactly where he was on the map, and mm-hmm. He said, "Do you know where you are?" And she said, "No, I don't." So instead of showing her where the sun was, he said, "If you don't know where you are, there's no point in my telling you where I am." There's always seems to be this difficulty with communication between mm-hmm. and extraterrestrials. It's happened right up to current times. And so he made the map disappear. And then she noticed a sort of like a book on a cabinet. It wasn't mm-hmm. What we think of as a book. It seemed plastic and was thick, but she opened it up, and inside that book she saw script. Now, the mm-hmm. interesting thing about this script is when I was doing the research for Captured, I asked Betty to sketch what she could remember of that script. And it had been mm-hmm. years and years since she had observed it. She took a little time. She took a couple of weeks. And finally, I went to visit her, and she had it written down on paper. Now, there was an alien study, a symbol study, academic experiment done involving mm-hmm. Don Dondery from McGill. He was in the psychology department there. Stuart Appel from the State University of New York, and Bud Hopkins from the Intruders Foundation. And Bud's abductees had sketched symbols that they had observed on the craft, and he had mm-hmm. copies of those. And then Stuart Appel hypnotized two groups of graduate students. One group of graduate students, 12 of those, and then the other group were not hypnotized. And they were all asked to sketch what they would imagine would be alien symbols. They did this, and then Dr. Dondery's students evaluated them on a multidimensional scale. They were all photocopied onto the same paper and framed so that there would be no way of knowing who did what. And it was very, very interesting that Hopkins' abductees' symbols had many, many similarities, but were not at all similar to the two groups of graduate students' symbols. Well, in the mm-hmm. end, Dr. Dondery took Betty's symbols and did a multidimensional analysis on those as well, and found that Betty's symbols were very, very similar to the symbols that Bud Hopkins' abductees had sketched, but mm-hmm. dissimilar, again, to the symbols that the graduate students had sketched. So this was a pretty important piece of scientific information here, I believe.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And before we get too far into the story, why don't you mention Marjorie Fish's star map, because this is good collaboration about the map that Betty saw on board.
Yes. Well, Marjorie Fish was a very brilliant woman from Ohio, a member of Mensa, an amateur astronomer. She'd majored in biology in college, and she was a school teacher at the time. And she had read the first book that was ever written about the case, The Interrupted Journey by John mm-hmm. Fuller, and that was published in 1966, the fall of 1966. She had read the book. She saw the star map in the book that Betty had sketched, as the result of a post-hypnotic suggestion by Dr. Benjamin Simon. She wondered if that the star map might represent a place in our galaxy. She was very skeptical about it, and she at first thought that she would find many, many matches. And she started to construct models. They were about 2 feet by 3 feet. They were three-dimensional, and she used monofilament line and beads of different sizes. Marjorie had some difficulty getting all of the distance data because the catalogs were only at the university, and she couldn't photocopy them. They didn't have photocopying equipment then, so she had to go to the university, and she had to copy all of this information by hand, take it back to her house, and put the beads in their proper location. And you can imagine the math this involved doing this. And she did this for about 3 years, and it was pretty frustrating. She was not able to find a match anywhere. She thought she'd find several. She didn't find one. So she was just going to be doing some more research, maybe going further out, when a new catalog was published. And she got that catalog, and in it were distance data for three stars that were on Betty's map that we previously didn't know about. And when she got that information, she had a perfect match for Betty's map. So that was a very significant finding because she had built 26 different models in her search for this. And there were actually 256 stars in their proper location on one of these models. So it was quite an extraordinary effort that she made. But in 1972, she found those last three stars and put them there. And the interesting thing is that on this star map, you can see the sun, and you can see nearby stars. Zeta Reticuli 1 and 2 are what she believed to be the base stars. And they are, one is 39.4 light years away, the other is 39.5 light years away from our sun. And they are believed to be at least 3 billion years older than our sun. So perhaps they developed intelligent life. Perhaps they had planets, and they do have beings who are coming here to Earth exploring. An important and interesting thing about the stars is that all of the patterned stars on Betty's map were sun-like, although only 5% of the 1,000 stars in our neighborhood out 54 light years are sun-like. So this was very unique. It wasn't something that you would find just anywhere looking into our galaxy. And all of the sun-like stars in that volume of space were on Betty's map.
Really?
And that was another significant finding. And also, all of them were in a plane instead of being spread out all over. Stan Friedman uses the sort of the visual image that think of a slice of pizza with pepperoni on the pizza as it opposed to a loaf of raisin bread with the raisins scattered throughout.
Right, yeah.
That makes it easier to travel, Stan told me, from one place to another. So he was actually the first scientist called in to look at Betty's map, Marjorie's work on Betty's map, and to look for astronomers who might be willing to vet Marjorie's work. And actually, they did find some astronomers. There was Walter Mitchell from Ohio State University. He was the chairman of the astronomy department there. It was also J. Allen Hynek from Northwestern University, who had been, of course, Project Blue Book's astronomical consultant, and also Dr. David Saunders, a statistician, psychologist who had been on the Condon Committee. Now, they vetted Marjorie's work and found that it was accurate. So this was very, very compelling. It convinced many scientists that the Hills story was real.
There was also the incident of the scientist that talked with Betty who wanted to know what they looked like. They met at her home, and he had information, independent information, about their appearance. So this Betty's experience was not the only experience that humans have had, evidently.
Yes, apparently this was secret information that we didn't know about at the time, but that he was.
Was he from the government? Is that the? I
believe that
where
he
was from.
With the Air Force.
Right.
Yes.
So, if indeed this is the area where these aliens are from, do you know of other any other abduction stories that have similar type of alien information or star map information or anything that that any other things that have happened that would place these aliens from a particular star system?
There's been a lot of controversy about that. Not many people have actually been shown star maps. Eric Wilson, who is a much more recent abductee, he and his wife, Katarina, are abductees who are on the internet. And he was shown a star map, he said, by one of the ETs, and it was, again, a holographic image. And he was of the opinion, I believe, that it was near Orion's belt. And so I'm not sure. It seems that this might be different from what Betty, or this identification might be different from what Betty saw. And it would be interesting as more accurate distance data comes forth and we learn more about different star systems in our galaxy and whether or not they have planets that might support life, if this is possible or where they actually do come from. Be very interesting.
Well, I imagine it's probably more than one group, from the different stories.
Yes, according to what abductees state, there appear to be a number of different body types, at least.
Right.
Groups coming.
Yeah. And probably different purposes as well. I mean, we have, evidence of gray abduction, interested in reproduction, and all sorts of other hidden agendas. Do you believe that Betty and Barney were ever abducted again, or did they believe they were abducted more than once?
Betty and Barney did not believe that they were abducted more than one time. They thought that they were just a couple of individuals out on the road. It was a lonely road that night, and that it was an opportunistic kind of abduction. And they felt they weren't taken again, although there seemed to be later contact sightings and close encounters that Betty and Barney had. I wonder if Betty might have been taken again, because Barney passed away from a cerebral hemorrhage at the age of 46 in February of 69. But Betty lived until 2004, when she died of lung cancer. There were some events in her files and things that I observed that just caused me to wonder if maybe she was still being taken. And one of those was of her, she owned an apartment building, and her upstairs neighbor and she were very good friends. And one night they were out on the road. They had gone to visit my family and were returning home to Portsmouth when a craft came down very, very close to them and paced their car right off the passenger side of the vehicle, traveling along only a few feet away from it, according to this report. And terrified Betty's neighbor. In fact, she said that she was never going to ride with Betty again. So I wonder.
Yeah, well, some of the folks who've presented at our Noetic Science meetings say that if you ever see a ship up close or a saucer up close, chances are you've been abducted. You just don't remember.
Yes,
and
that
struck me as an interesting statement, but one that could very possibly be true. It's just that they don't bother coming around if they're just, you know, they're not just sightseeing. You know, it's they have a particular mission in mind, and you're part of it. So that could be. And then the other thing I was wondering, and I don't know whether you have any insight into this, but didn't Barney say, "Oh no, not again," or something like that, with the first one?
Yeah,
didn't I read that?
Yes,
what was that about?
Say, "Oh no, not again." Now we don't know if that
what was he referring to
that he was abducted once before, and he's being abducted again. Or
well,
it's
suspicious.
He observed this craft from the field, and oh no, here it is again.
Right, right.
And
but I had
in the road
when I read it. It occurred to me that maybe he had been abducted before. I don't know why, you know, but it was just interesting because, I mean, actually, these abductions probably are fairly, without hypnotic recall, and now people specialize in that, or hypnotherapists specialize in this, without hypnotic recall, the majority of people abducted have no memory of it at all. Except maybe they think they might have seen a UFO.
Yes, I mean, well, maybe about 30% actually have conscious recall of observing the craft, observing non-human entities, and being on the craft. The other 70% don't remember very much of it. They might remember observing a craft, and some people don't even remember observing a craft, but just wonder if they might have been abducted because they've dreamed of it.
Right. And it is often in the dreams. That's true as well.
Yes.
There's often dream material about abduction.
Yes. Yes.
Very common.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have to assume there's many different agendas, you know, many different, and many different types of beings. Some are very advanced beings. Which really probably do not participate in abductions, and then other many different kind of beings that some of whom do participate in abductions.
Yes, and it seems that there are three or four types who are seen working together on these craft. Mm-hmm. I'm an abduction researcher and investigator. Mm-hmm. In fact, for the Mutual UFO Network, I am their abduction specialist. So I've been investigating and researching this phenomenon for over 20 years now. And many people have reported that they have observed the small grays, the taller grays, the hybrid type beings that they look pretty human but have larger eyes than humans, seem to be telepathic, seem to be the products of this reproductive experimentation that's going on by the Greys. They also report observing occasionally, and a far smaller percentage of abductees report observing these other types. And those are a reptilian type, who are 6 to 7 feet tall, have scaly skin, who are sort of have a negative kind of persona, very frightening. Mm-hmm. There's also another type that reminds people of praying mantises. They're about 6 feet tall, too, and very thin, thin skeletal in their appearance, kind of bumpy skin. They're very frightening for humans to observe.
Yeah, just about all of them.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. And of course, on the other end of the scale are the ones who are the benevolent human-looking beings that they call the Nordic type as well.
Right.
So,
tall.
And that goes back to the reports made during the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, the Nordic types are usually tall and have remarkable athletic abilities, like they can run really fast and stuff like that. So they're not. If you observe them, you can pretty soon tell they're not human just by the way they're moving around.
Yes, and very attractive looking.
Right.
Individual.
Yeah, and exactly. Have you had the chance to read Alien Mind?
No, I haven't read Alien Mind. Who is the author?
God, I can't remember the author, but if you Google it, Alien Mind, you can actually download the book off the author's website. And it's the one with the alien, there's actually two books called Alien Mind, but this is an investigative reporter's account of spending about 10,000 hours with aliens that he claims are working with our government. And it talks about the Greys and the Verdants and then the higher level people that are over the Verdants that are much more evolved and much more live a lot longer. And he talks about the three groups that are involved. And it's just one of the most fascinating books I've ever read. It talks a lot about why free energy is not free, including a lot about Tom Bearden's work. And I had been to the Truth Convention. In fact, you and I met in the bathroom there, actually, for the first time, if you remember.
I
said, yeah, I want to interview you for my show. but neither Stephen Greer nor David Wilcox had ever heard of Alien Mind. And since both of them are proponents of free energy, I suggested that they might want to read the physics. And I even called Tom Bearden up, who's right across here. I'm in Georgia. He's in Alabama. And I asked him if he had read Alien Mind, and he said no, he'd never heard of it. So I think everybody ought to read Alien Mind and look at the physics, because before we go around claiming that free energy is going to set us free, we need to take a look at this bit of information. But it's one of the most fascinating books I've ever read. And like I said, it's free on the Internet. You can download it and read it at your leisure. And but a very interesting perspective of what the aliens think of us.
And where did the author obtain the information from?
He's an investigative journalist. I mean, that's his job. He's got other books, and he claims to have spent 10,000 hours with these three sets of groups of aliens interviewing them.
Hmm.
So. You know, I mean, I can't claim to, you know, verify the book at all, but certainly as a researcher, you might want to take a look at it and see what you can come up with. Maybe speak to the author.
Actually, the information is consistent with the information that I've been receiving.
Exactly. So the Greys, in the book, they say the Greys used free energy without restraint and burned out their sun, and that's why they're dependent on the Verdants, who are more reptilian, to do these experiments with humans to produce hybrids, okay? And then later on in the book, the ones that are over the Verdants, who are evidently very older and much wiser, there's a point in the book where he's accusing them of using unethical techniques to control world population, you know, involving the AIDS virus and some other things like that. I'll let you read the book. But the older and wiser alien says, well, what then is your solution to overpopulation of the Earth? And he just sits there and says, you know, like, whoops. So very interesting conversations. And it makes you wonder to what degree these groups are involved in what has happened on Earth. So, you know, there could be a much larger agenda at work.
Scenarios as well, supposedly coming from the Greys or conversations with the Greys. So,
right.
That are not the same as that one. So,
Well, it'd be a good idea to take a look at the book and see what, maybe get in touch with the author and see what you think. Is it disinformation or is it, you know, even if it's disinformation, there's always some truth in disinformation, as you know. So, but anyway, I just think it's one of the more fascinating books, especially the physics, which actually seems to pan out. Free energy really isn't free. When you use free energy indiscriminately, what you do is you speed up time and you burn out your sun quicker. I mean, and you can really speed it up a lot, evidently. And they use Tom Bearden's math, you know, to show you this. And I don't know if you ever looked on Tom Bearden's website, but it's really hard to understand all what he says if you're not a physicist or a mathematician. But this book, this investigative reporter, has done a really good job of making it so I could understand it, you know, and you know, people who are not in the field could probably understand the relationship of all of these factors, you know, what. And you know, we basically are coming to the point, if you've listened to David Wilcox, which I'm sure you did, of understanding a little bit more about how these spacecraft, you know, flit in and out of our third-dimensional reality. You know, they probably go into something else and then come back out. You know, we need to understand the dimensional nature of this travel.
Yes, we do. And if you if you go online to YouTube, and you look up Rudy Shield, or Dr. Rudolf Shield, S-C-H-I-L-D, you will find some recent interviews with him. He's an astrophysicist who has done some very good interviews recently on all of this.
Great. Gives you I will do that. Rudolf Shield.
Yes, S-C-H-I-L-D,
okay, great.
From Harvard.
Great. Well, Kathleen, we're coming up to the end of the hour. Would you like to give some contact information for our audience?
Yes, absolutely. You can go to my website. It is www.Kathleen, K-A-T-H-L-E-N, -Marden, M-A-R-D-E-N, .com. And all of my books and DVDs are available for purchase there. They're all autographed by myself, and the ones that I wrote with Stan Friedman are autographed by both of us. I also have several articles online that you can read and photograph. One of the great ones is of a new historical marker in the state of New Hampshire. The state erected this in honor of Betty and Barney last September to commemorate their UFO experience.
Well, that's wonderful. That's it looks like we may be in a new dawning of enlightenment about what is actually going on in our on Earth, and not have our heads in the sand, hopefully.
Certainly so.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Kathleen. It's been a great interview, and I look forward to, you know, your looking at your website. And we've been talking with Kathleen Marden, the author of Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. Kathleen is the niece of Betty Hill and has been involved since the beginning of this adventure. And I highly recommend you go to her website and see what else she's learned as a UFO and abductee researcher. This is Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Next week we will be interviewing Michael Cremo on the hidden history of the human race. And on the 17th, Paul von Vord, We've Never Been Alone, A History of Extraterrestrial Intervention. And then on the 24th, Robert Foreman, Enlightenment Ain't What It Cracked Up to Be. And then we go back to health. It's actually Temple of Health on the on the 31st, Embrace, Release, and Heal, an empowering guide to talking about, thinking about, and treating cancer. Noetic Science Meeting is on Thursday, March 15th. Our guest speaker will be Dr. Fadimi, discussing his book, The Episode of Life, Consciousness, Creation, and the Universe. This will be at the Dunwoody location at 7:15 p.m. I also want to remind people to look at the I Can Do It retreat. This is a motivating mind, body, and soul event coming to Atlanta, San Jose, Vancouver, and Toronto in the upcoming months. Some of the authors like Dr. Wayne Dyer, Marianne Williamson, Greg Braden, Louise Hay, and others. You can find out more about it at icandoit.net to find out for dates for a city near you, or call 1-800-654-5126. Again, thanks so much, Kathleen, for joining us. It was a fascinating interview.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Join us next week.